Hello there and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and a week's worth of sounds, including Jennifer Walsh on her meeting with the Boyo in a moment, a celebration of the macro lens of photographer Tina Claffey, activist jewellery in Mayo, and composer Susan Gainey leads us in some deep listening. But we start this weekly with the latest adventures of the touring music maker with Jennifer Walsh. The composer and musician has recently been having an experience she'd rather not. She's finally made close contact with the non-human life form that will, from this day onward, be forever known as the Boyo. This is Jennifer Walsh's Things Know Things.
The last couple of weeks have, unfortunately, been a bit of a wash. I finally caught what my neighbour in Roscommon refers to as the Boyo. I was at a music festival in Germany when I tested positive. It was a Saturday, the end of an intense and idyllic week spent rehearsing and performing with lots of different musicians. That morning, I'd done a concert with two saxophonists in a church, and I was very excited about the show I was due to do that night with my friends Matt Moss and Wobbly. This was supposed to be the culmination of the week. Like all musicians, on the day of a show, I took a nap that afternoon and woke up feeling very wrong. And you can surely guess how the rest goes. Those two lines appearing within 50 seconds of doing the test, panicked phone calls to the festival, to everyone I'd been with that day, to the other musicians who needed to restructure the show without me, and the horrible realization that the "Do Not Disturb" sign on my door now carried a great deal more weight. I should say right away that I was very lucky. The festival took very good care of me. But getting COVID while you're away is not an experience any musician ever wants. You're holed up in a hotel room, Google translating the instructions for German medicines, listening to everyone else from the festival partying outside. You watch your own concert on your phone, weeping a little, but also in awe of how the musicians you work with are so endlessly adaptable, sharp, and excellent at improvisation. You run out of clean clothes, so the festival gives you festival t-shirts, which you wear for days like some sort of musician illness uniform. And you watch endless climbing documentaries on National Geographic, weak and short of breath throughout. And the whole time, you're texting with people from the festival and beyond who all now have COVID. That's when it turns into a bizarre research project, when the idiosyncrasies of COVID become terrifyingly vivid. There's the synth player stuck in his basement who has a terrible fever but no cough. The wind player who started having piercing body pains on night 4. The producer who tested negative, then positive, then negative, then positive. Somebody loses their sense of taste and smell. Somebody else can't seem to get out of bed, and somebody seems to feel completely fine. What is this illness, where no two people have the same experience? The only commonality seems to be that everybody is worried about everybody else. Exchanging advice, commiseration and information, tips. Take 3 times the daily recommended amount of vitamin C and D. Take 2 drops of hemp oil at night. Do the John Hopkins breathing exercises. And everybody is talking about the gigs they've had to cancel, as well as the gigs they may well have to cancel. One-off performances that cannot be rescheduled. Travel expenses which have been paid for in advance and will now never be reimbursed. A month's worth of income. 2 months' worth of income, disappearing just like that. I had thought once I'd had COVID, the immunity would make me feel at ease, but actually it's the opposite. The summer seems a little bit less cheerful and the autumn darker still. For myself and many of the musicians I know, almost 8 months past our most recent jobs with no more boosters in sight, the only choice is to continue masking, restrict our contacts, and let the biggest risk we expose ourselves to be the audiences we play for.
Jennifer Walsh there shaking off the boyo kind of makes you think it wouldn't be crazy for audiences to wear masks. And next on the Culture File Weekly, a wander into the world of Maeve Stone, director, writer, curator, climate activist, and lately in a bout of nominative determinism, jewellery maker. The last two hyphens join linked activities as Stone's journey into the natural world and its perilous state brought her back to creating objects that respond to the climate as she experiences it in her base in Mayo. Culture File's Niamh Daly went to meet Maeve Stone in a little part of what's left of the natural world.
We as a species started to understand ourselves as outside nature, and all of that has informed how we interact with natural space. The interesting offer on the table right now is the opportunity to transform again as a species and to understand that our happiest moments are the ones where we see ourselves and understand ourselves to be a part of nature. My name is Maeve Stone. I'm an artist working primarily in theatre and film, but also, I guess, more recently making jewellery. I've always made jewellery, but I've never sold it before. And so Stone Circle grew out of the response I had to nature during the early lockdowns and in moving to the west of Ireland and just kind of being immersed in the landscape in County Clare had a huge and profound impact on my imagination. But it was a way of having a focus or a purpose in how I was interacting with the landscape around here and the seascape. It's just such a beautiful environment. The way that I approach it is to take a theme that I'm inspired by sort of seasonally. So if it's the summertime, it might be something in what's happening in the wildflowers or what's happening in the seaweed or what's happening, you know, in the bird population. And that would become the inspiration for a collection. And there's a few spaces that I just absolutely adore. One is the Glen. It's kind of a hidden ancient forest and it's just incredible. It's like a portal or something. The path leads you up into past a river which is kind of running through rock that's been worn away over centuries, and it has that kind of the Scanner stone that sort of, it's very dramatic and it's so unexpected, you know, like you're kind of on a path down behind a hotel and you keep going and it gets richer and denser. And I think that those kind of places can help us reconnect with ourselves as a part of nature as well.
It's kind of the start of the portal, I would say. You're starting to separate yourself out a little bit. We are standing in a kind of a gully, I suppose, and the bottom is a very dark kind of rock that looks to me like it might be Liscannor stone. And it's a beautiful kind of dark colour with the fast-flowing stream running through it. And in the wintertime, that gets quite big. And you can see where the track for the water has been eaten out over probably millions of years by the water. So one of the things I love about the Glen and the walk that you go on is it feels like it brings you back in time. And it sort of teaches you something about how big time is. There's something about seeing the layers in the rock and seeing it rising up in this way that I find really exciting.
The work that I make in a broader sense as an artist is really engaging with the climate crisis and with the stories that we tell that help people to connect into what those futures might look like, and bringing people into the picture where data and science can sometimes be a bit alienating. And I think that Stone Circle is another way of telling stories about nature and getting people to think about their local environment in a way that is opening up that conversation, I hope. The Project Art Centre invited me to be artivist in residence for the year, and the residency has three key projects, I suppose. The first one was a magazine called How Do We Start? And so it's Kasia Kaminska and the Guild Project, and she looks at wildflowers and nature as a collaborator, and she does beautiful anthotype printing. The magazine has a step-by-step instruction for that that she's included, which is great. And Katie Holton, she's created a seed alphabet. And then there's Luke Casserly and Shanna May Breen, who were looking at the bogs in Offaly as a space for creative imagination. And then the final contributor is Kajal Modi, and she included a piece about fermentation as a form of resistance to capitalist structure, and there's instructions and recipes. For me, it felt like a really interesting way of connecting to Ireland's relationship to land and to food. So that was a really gorgeous opportunity to commission artists whose work I have really benefited from over the last couple of years. And then the other project is Decarbonising Limerick, which is a project that has just begun, and it's going to be a collaboration with the Civic Trust in Limerick and looking at the spaces that they manage across the city. So they have a huge staff, and how that translates in terms of the work they do is that it's a really diverse group of people. And for us and the work that we do, that's another really key element of it. Needs to be intersectional. It needs to be kind of rooted in an understanding that climate justice is about equality across society. When we build the new systems, they can't be as oppressive and unequal as the ones we currently have.
You heard there from activist jeweller, among other things, Maeve Stone, and the reporter was Niamh Daly. Even deeper listening than normal next with the composer Susan Gainey. Kirkos Ensemble are playing Gainey's work Tape Melt later this month as part of their 10th anniversary celebrations, which will be held at their North Dublin Performance Space Unit 44, more of which in a moment. Gainey's work is strongly influenced by the deep listening theories of Pauline Oliveros, with whom she studied. Deep listening, she explains, is a way of carefully tuning into the world that can have powerful effects not just for composers, but for anyone who'd like to experience the world around them a little more thoughtfully.
My name is Susan Gainey, and I'm a composer, improviser and sound artist from County Kerry. For me, it's all about the experimental process in sound and the curiosity that kind of stems from kind of the base of everything that I do. I do a lot of field recordings, and everywhere I go, even at the moment in France, I have the Zoom on the go and I record lots of different environmental sounds and incorporate them live with live musicians in live performance, or mix them in with live music as well. Deep listening, I worked with Pauline Oliveros, would have kind of played a big factor in how I approach sound, and I use deep listening and sonic meditations kind of a core thing that I always kind of default to as well.
Tell us a bit about, for people who don't know her, who Pauline Oliveros is and what she's responsible for.
Pauline Oliveros, she kind of started a movement called Deep Listening, which kind of formed the basis of, you know, how we listen and everyday sounds and how to kind of deepen our listening and awareness. So it's more focal listening, so we can kind of get deeper in and out and tuned into what is actually happening in the sounds that we're hearing around us. And there's various different levels of listening, just like in meditation, there's various different levels that you can get to. In meditation, you can really switch on your listening to a whole other level, and you can switch it off as well, like, so that you're not constantly bombarded and overwhelmed by all the sounds as well. So she kind of teaches you through various sonic meditations that she's kind of explored to help everyone. It's not just for composers, it's for anyone, just to kind of build more of an awareness to our surroundings and what's going on. It's her deep listening sonic meditations that really anyone can explore, and it really deepens your listening and kind of turns you on to the world around you in a way that for me it hadn't before when I encountered her. And luckily I got to work with her as well.
What was she like?
Really, really chilled out, you know, like just lovely presence, you know, that kind of aura when you're around someone and you're like instantly relaxed. It's like I did her deep listening retreat, and it was quite a lot of it was silent. but it was constantly focusing on sounds and, you know, allowing us to get quieter so that we kind of, our whole bodies become absorbers and receivers of sound. Yeah, it's kind of formed a big impression on me and my work and how I think about sound.
Tell us how you get started there. I suppose as much as you say for an ordinary person as for a composer, what is the beginning of getting into deep listening?
I suppose there is certain sonic meditations that are guided that can help when you're starting in the beginning, and they really strike a chord with your imagination. So they're trying to get you into a different headspace. So I definitely wouldn't start and say, okay, everyone, just close your eyes and just listen, you know, to the sounds around you. You can, it's nice to have some guided at the beginning, like they'll guide you in various ways, in ways to listen, shapes, or like listening to a certain area of the room versus this area, trying to get you more inward, listening to your own body, your inner workings, and then expanding from there. So kind of getting into a calm state so you can really receive sound through vibrations in the body, and just getting into that kind of relaxed state. But deep listening, if you become a deep listening practitioner, it's open for everybody. It's anyone, you know, who can listen and absorb sound and are interested in sound, they can all take something for this. It is quite a deep meditative process. It's just focusing on one aspect of our senses. Yeah, you can go anywhere with this, and it sparks and opens up your creativity and makes you listen and absorb the world around you in a different lens. It just reignites kind of an excited energy to the world around you, which we all need more of, you know. And I think that's something I'd love to see incorporated more in concerts, even just the concept of deep listening and sonic meditations, to do them with audiences, to get them more involved and interactive and engaged, would be, I think, a very enriched experience for them as well.
We're now currently in a space which, you know, acoustically, you and I at the moment, acoustically is kind of horrible. We're listening to each other through a strainer or something.
Yeah.
If we were to attempt to practice deep listening in this sort of very artificial video conferencing kind of world, what are the things that are attracting your attention about this listening?
I think it's the space in between. So I think what I love about deep listening is that the space in what I'm hearing now, where I'm sitting with this headset and this room, is, you know, it's completely different to the experience that you have in your room, you know. But at the same time, we have this other experience through the screen and through the headphones as well. And there's that space between us speaking and talking, and there's this kind of transmission of space that has this kind of slight tingling kind of sensation and feeling that we can hear and feel as well at the same time. So it's just very interesting. But we'd have to be quiet to really kind of listen to that.
Yeah. Let's give it a few seconds, will we, and just see what's going on. And maybe when something strikes you, you'd tell us about it. I'll just stop talking for a minute and you come back in when you'd like to say something. At this point, if you could imagine, about a minute goes by.
So right there, I can hear a slight bit of your breath. I can hear the hiss, you know, that we have between us. I can hear my heartbeat. Or I can hear something ticking away because of my headphones. You know, I can feel a sense of my inner workings a little bit. I also felt that there was something, a sound, there's a window above me, so there was a slight little sound there. So there's so many things going on. I'm not sure what you experienced there, but, you know, you could focal in, and if what I was doing was kind of starting with myself, and then I came out through the screen to you and back to myself, and through there I listened and felt certain things happening. You know, if we had longer time, we could keep going and see really what could we hear and feel, you know.
What I was feeling there was that if I was going to be breathing, that was sort of such a loud and intrusive sound. I should, you know, I should hold my breath because it was so dominating the space.
That's what I love about Pauline as well. It's all about the space and the environment that we're in, you know, so each environment and space is going to produce something different. Tape Melt will be released on an Irish cassette label called Fort Evil Fruit just before I have the performance with Kirkos. You know, Kirkus have a space called Unit 44, and, you know, this piece would not probably have a platform or a space to be performed if it wasn't for them offering up this space for more informal kind of setups and experimentations. So just very thankful to have that facility and have that should and hopefully that this will continue on in Dublin, that there will be spaces like this for artists to have informal gigs and get underground music kind of represented in performance spaces.
Because it is a problem that, you know, that Kirkus has that space for the moment, but, you know, that's only chance, isn't it?
Absolutely. And they could have used that for their own means and needs and performances, but they offered it up because there is such a thirst and need for, like, there's a lot of music that I discovered through Unit 44 and even poetry and writers and so many other artists from different avenues that I have discovered because of Unit 44 giving this platform, that they don't have to rent out a space, you know, that there isn't money is not the fee all and end all of being able to get the music out there. It's incredible. And I think it needs to be part of every artistic landscape. If you go to other European cities, I mean, there's always informal spaces for this kind of experimental cross collaboration between art forms. And I think Dublin has been lacking that for a long time. And we need spaces like this. And this proves it because of the richness that's coming out of Unit 44. There's always the formal space, but there has to be that other avenue as well.
Susan Gainey there, and that performance of Tape Melt is on July 29th at Kirkus Ensemble's Unit 44 in Prussia Street, Dublin, and kirkusensemble.com for details of all their 10th anniversary events. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, the latest volume to be added to our ideal shelf of books about the natural world. Normally, it's the words that Paddy Woodworth is prizing here, but sometimes there's no beating simply looking. So as the world enjoys brand new images from round the bend of space-time via the James Webb Telescope, Paddy celebrates the tiny worlds beneath our feet via the macro lens of Tina Claffey. As he slides the Irish photographer's book of close-up wonders, Portal, from the Naturalist bookshelf.
The books we have taken down from our shelf for this programme so far are celebrated for their words, though some, like Michael Viney's A Year's Turning, are also enriched by fine illustrations. As a child, however, it was the images in nature books that held more magic for me than words. I'm now lucky enough to be able to see, in real life, reintroduced red kites almost daily, without leaving my home place in Glenmalure Valley. But still, when I picture this elegant bird of prey, I find etched on my mind's eye the archetype of a tiny reproduction of Archibald Thorburn's painting in the pocket-sized Observer's Book of British Birds that I wore out in childhood. This prolific Victorian artist perfectly evoked the misty remoteness of a creature that had then been reduced to its last stronghold in these islands, deep in the Welsh mountains. Thorburn's gift for portraying birds and mammals is mirrored in our own rich and long tradition of botanical art, vividly revealed in the National Gallery's 2020 Drawn from Nature exhibition. The frequently tiny sexual parts of plants, which we politely call flowers, with all their myriad ingenious variety and intense erotic connotations, offer exceptional opportunities for exquisite illustrations at a very large scale. They are often presented in juxtapositions never seen in nature, but very striking as art on the page. Only a powerful hand lens can make some of these organs visible, at least in all their glory, to the naked human eye. And using a hand lens is a little like snorkeling. It gives you entry into vast and strange new worlds, but without the inconvenience of getting wet. In recent years, macro photography has offered another very potent window on the worlds inhabited by small plants and animals. In her new book, aptly called Portal, Irish photographer Tina Claffey plunges us into the hallucinatory multiverse of our bogs, wetlands and eskers. It is a book to bathe and balm the soul with its mesmerising beauty. Claffey repeatedly refers to her images as otherworldly, and that's a valid reading. But I prefer to think of them as very worldly and earthy indeed. It's just not the world and the earth that we like to think we know, and with which we so easily become jaded. The spore heads of horsetails, for example, are a very common and accessible sight in season. You might drive past 1,000 of these non-flowering plants on a damp roadside bank in a minute, and beyond their impudently phallic general shape, you might not pay them any further attention. Claffey's camera, however, reveals their spores as set out in elongated ovoids, scintillating patterns of pale pink hexagonals or indigo stars. Eat your heart out, Fabergé. Nature beat you to making designer eggs, and a long time ago too. As Claffey points out, horsetails predate the dinosaurs. Bogs are Claffey's great love, and she clearly feels an unabashed spiritual relationship with these ever-shifting mosaics of plants, water, and insects. She reflects, with exceptional intensity, a welcome transition that has been taking place in recent years, shifting our public perception of peatlands from wastelands to Irish rainforests. If you think that is hyperbole, just open these large format pages. Sometimes, Claffey writes in one caption, nature reveals such treasures that all I can do is give gratitude. In that particular case, the revelation, not visible except as something tiny floating on the surface of the bog pool until she focused her macro, is a pair of mating snails, their bodies cobalt blue against coppery water. With Claffey as our guide, we become Lilliputians in forests of lichen, with names like bog beacon, trumpet cup, and devil's matchstick. She sometimes photographs the same species several times, reminding us that a fungus can be as individually distinctive as an oak. Unlike Annie Dillard, she is unperturbed by the ubiquity of killing in the natural world she loves so deeply. Unfortunate midges, glittering like gems in a mist-spangled spider's web, are simply a good morning for the spider. Claffey's work is a very material realization of Blake's aphorism that if the doors of perception were cleansed, then everything would appear to us as it is, infinite. Her images evoke a sense of awe before the exquisite intricacies of the natural world, and they help us to learn to love it better. And that is surely one of the ways in which we may be moved to stop destroying it. If you find you love this book, then get a hand lens or a macro camera and take a deep dive into this world yourself. You don't have to go further than the nearest plant.
Paddy Woodworth there on Tina Claffey's Portal, the latest addition to the Naturalist bookshelf. And to find all the volumes up there, follow at CultureFilePod on Twitter. And that brings to a close this edition of the CultureFile Weekly. We'll be back with more microcosmic snaps next Saturday tea time on RTE Lyric FM and via podcast all the rest of the time. Till then, bye now.